Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's July 20th. Let's see. Currently, we've got 69 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies, 67 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Monday. It's going to be a hot one out there for you this afternoon, so make sure you're staying hydrated. We're looking at partly cloudy skies. We will have a low-end chance of another isolated thunderstorm or two popping up this afternoon. Temperatures warming up to around 90 degrees in Park City. We're climbing into the mid-90s for in the Heber Valley as we go throughout this afternoon. Now, as we go into the rest of the week, we're going to start to see another resurgence of that monsoonal moisture moving across the area. That means we're going to be looking at good chances for showers and storms developing in the afternoon hours for your Tuesday and for your Wednesday. In fact, it becomes fairly likely, especially by Wednesday. We're looking at high temperatures because of that cooling down. We'll be in the upper 80s in Park City on your Tuesday. We'll be only in the low 80s expected for your Wednesday with that really good chance of those showers and storms. The Heber Valley, we're looking at scattered shower and storm chances ramping up as well. Low to mid 90s for your Tuesday, but we're down into the upper 80s for your Wednesday with that good chance of showers and storms. Beyond that, we'll keep a good chance of showers and storms in the forecast once again for your Thursday. During all of these days, we will see an elevated flash flood risk begin to shift north across the northern half of the state. So be aware that will become a potential as we'll be looking at that chance of showers and storms for your Thursday. Low 80s for your highs in Park City, upper 80s in the Heber Valley. Now, the good news is, as we head towards the weekend, we will slowly start to trend those rain chances lower. Thursday and Friday, we'll keep it around a 30 to 40% chance of a few isolated showers and storms. Highs in the mid-80s in Park City, low 90s in the Heber Valley. By the time we head into the weekend, particularly by the time we get towards your Sunday, I think those rain chances really drop off to a very slim chance, partly cloudy skies and temperatures in the mid-80s for highs in Park City, and we'll have those highs in the low 90s in the Heber Valley. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour, I'll be checking in with the CEO of Park City Chamber Bureau, Jennifer Wesselhoff. We'll take a look at the summer lodging numbers. Kimball Arts Center Executive Director Aldi Milliken in with the latest on the current exhibit and the planning for a new center, and just a few weeks away from the Arts Festival. Snyderville Basin Recreation District Director Robert Parrish in to talk a little bit about the proposed $150 million recreation bond. Well, scammers are impersonating Summit County courts and planning departments. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports residents say they have received fraudulent emails and bills.
Unknown scammers are using publicly available information to target Utahns, trying to swindle them out of thousands. That includes posing as the Park City and Summit County planning departments. Summit County planner Tiffany Robinson says Tony Tyler, known for developing properties on Main Street and in the Snyderville Basin, recently received a fraudulent bill.
Tony received one Monday night. And it says it's a bill from the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission to the applicants for different fees, naming their project and everything, yeah.
Park City Municipal and the Utah State Court System are hearing the same thing from residents. Scammers are posing as official government agencies and demanding wire transfers or gift cards. State courts officials say the scams can often involve official-looking but fake AI-generated documents. They say urgency, threats, strange phone numbers, and unfamiliar documents or details can all be signs of something fishy. Park City reminds residents that legitimate communications will only come from verified .gov email addresses. The city encouraged anyone to call and verify with the official source if they think they're being scammed. Park City will never tell residents, quote, only respond to this email and its communications. Scams can be reported to local law enforcement, scams.utah.gov, or the Federal Internet Crime Complaint Center. More information about how to spot and avoid scams is at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from the Park City Chamber Bureau, I have CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. So let's start with the lodging data, and this goes through June 30th.
Right. I have data through June 30th, and it's really a mixed but stable picture, if I had to describe it. June occupancy ticked up about 3%, and rates are really starting to level off. We're seeing rates for June came down about 4%, and July is running in the opposite direction right now. July occupancy forecast on the books is down about 6%, and rates are up 3%. A positive outlook for August and September forecasts. Occupancy for August is up double digits right now. And September forecast is also up about 7%. So overall, I think the next 6 months look encouraging. The next 6 months, on average, occupancy is up ahead of pace about 2%, and rates are really leveling off.
Okay. I mean, I guess, is that wedding season? Has that got something to do with it, or?
Certainly. Groups, corporate groups, really that segmentation of our tourism market, particularly in the spring, summer, and fall, is what drives our tourism industry at that time. So you're also seeing a mixed bag in terms of how hotel properties are performing during this time as well. Those properties that are catering to the medium to larger groups are outperforming. And for me, what this is really just, it's suggesting that there's value consciousness in the marketplace, but there are real signs of demand returning, which is really good. For me, I also think it's just a normalization story. We're looking at some rate discipline plus a strengthening forward look. And overall, that's really what we want to see in, as we're working through what I'm calling a post-peak adjustment.
Okay, so how are these numbers in the future, figured?
Actually, the Destametrics data is one of the best in the country to show us forward-looking data. There are only a handful of companies that do that. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is every month, actually twice a month, our hotel properties that are participating in this platform are putting in their reservations and their bookings. So we're able to see on a month-to-month basis how we performed looking back, and also how we're looking forward to forecast.
So is it just self-selected then? People pay to be part of this? Or is it really a median, look?
We encourage all properties to participate. There is a small fee to participate. It's a very expensive platform, and we subsidize most of it. But we are looking at new ways to incentivize hotel properties to participate, because we'd rather have more inventory or more properties participating to get better numbers than have the revenue that is associated with it.
Okay. And then as you look at these lodging numbers, how do they translate into the Summit County tax collections?
Unfortunately, we still only have June numbers for sales tax collections, which represent April performance. So again, sort of looking back, there's really no surprises for April performance. We all remember what the snow situation was. But for April performance, local sales taxes are the success story, really up over 10%. And then all of the other tax collections, we're looking at restaurant taxes, were down 16%. Transient room taxes down for April 7%. We did see an uptick in recreation, arts, and parks about 3%, which is positive. So looking at the last 6 months in sales tax collections for the county year to date, local sales taxes are up year to date 3.5%, and then all of those other categories are down anywhere from 4% to transient room tax being down 8%.
Okay, let's see. July is Disability Awareness Month, and in partnership with the National Ability Center, the Chamber and business community have launched a new accessibility program. Tell us about this.
We are so proud of this program, and maybe if I could just take your listeners back a few years when we developed and launched our Sustainable Tourism Plan, which is a community-wide plan. Sustainability is about building a destination that really works for everyone. Truly, a sustainable community is one that is durable economically, socially, and environmentally. And part of that is our vision to be the most sustainable destination in the world. And truly, you can't claim that while leaving out a huge portion of travelers and people with mobility challenges, sensory disabilities, chronic conditions. And those travelers consistently tell us that they struggle to find good information about whether a place, whether it's a hotel, a restaurant, an activity, an attraction, if those places really work for people with disabilities. So this program, Wheel the World, it helps us close that gap. And it connects directly to our sustainable tourism plan, which we're really proud of. This year, we had 30 businesses participate in the program. It's a partnership with the National Ability Center, and it's a verified third party that comes in with their measuring tape, and they actually measure how wide the windows are, how high the steps are, how accessible your business is. And our goal, we're launching this year with 30 businesses. Our goal is to add 30 businesses every year, so by the time 2034 and beyond comes around, we have over 250 businesses that are verified, Wheel the World verified.
Yeah, I like that name. And then again, what's happening this Thursday?
Yeah, this Thursday we're doing a celebration for the launch of those 30 businesses. It's July 23rd at the National Ability Center. We're really proud to have a panel of folks with disabilities to talk to us about the challenges that they have in traveling so that our community can better understand the importance of having a welcoming and inclusive and accessible destination.
Okay. Let's see. The Chamber also handed out its annual Sustainable Tourism Grants. Talk to us a little bit about what these are for and who receives them.
We did. We have a grant this year of $150,000 for businesses and nonprofits to help us live up to the initiatives and the programs, the promotions, the events, all associated with the 7 objectives of our sustainable tourism plan. I think it was one of the things that I learned in Arizona when I was there and developed Arizona's first sustainability plan for Sedona. I learned that if our businesses, if our nonprofits, if our government entities aren't also living the plan, breathing the plan, executing the plan, that it doesn't work as well. So really, this grant is a way to encourage our businesses to engage in sustainable tourism. We gave out 17 grants this year, and they were all really about equally focused on, as we look at the allocation, equally focused on visitor education, visitor disbursement, visitor impact management, arts and culture, and product development.
Okay. Do you have names and in terms of some of those that we'll receive?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples so that you can kind of better understand what we mean when we say sustainable tourism. We just talked about the Wheel the World program and sustainable tourism, meaning inclusivity, accessibility, and now our sustainable tourism grants, the many of the applications fall into visitor dispersion, so moving people around the county, elevating arts and culture. A good example of that is a project that we partially funded with the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County. This is the Summit Arts Market, which is an annual summer event, and it's in Oakley. So we really love the idea of sharing those tourism dollars in the broader county to support local artists and cultivate collectors who really live on the eastern side of the county. And it supports 40 local artists. So with the loss of Sundance, we looked at the grant as a way to also help us elevate the arts in the community. Another good example of that is funding for Park City Film. They were seeking support for 2 new film programs that were created by Park City Film. to help fill that cultural gap. The first is Midnight in Park City, which is a series in August. It's a weekend film program comprised of about 4 to 6 different thrillers and dark comedies. And then secondarily, the Park City Film Festival in October will be a program of 8 films that has been curated through the film festival circuit. We really like this because it helped elevate our arts, but it also helped visitor dispersion in time when we need business, when you look at August and you also look at October.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
More information can be found at parkcitychamber.com. We encourage folks to follow us on social media. Lots of great information there, and have a wonderful summer.
Okay, Jennifer, thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, lightning sparked a new wildfire Sunday afternoon in Wasatch County. Wasatch Fire District Battalion Chief Chaz Ray estimated the Meeks Fire was burning some 10 to 15 acres as of yesterday afternoon. It's about 8 miles east of Strawberry Reservoir. The fire started Sunday afternoon about 3:15 near Buckhorn Ranch, which is north of US 40 between Strawberry Reservoir and the Duchesne County line. Crews from Wasatch and Duchesne counties are responding to the fire. No structures are threatened. Sunday's wildfire comes about a week after lightning sparked the Buck Basin Fire elsewhere in Wasatch County. That fire was 96% contained as of Saturday evening, according to U.S. Forest Service. U.S. Forest Service spokesperson Brenda Bushell said that the rain helped, but firefighters also have to pause their efforts for safety anytime there is lightning in the area. New fire starts are also a concern. As we reported, lightning sparked that Buck Basin Fire 16 miles southeast of Heber City July 11th.
With a lightning strike fire, it could take a week for that fire to all of a sudden show visible enough that we can see it. And that's kind of what happened with this one.
The Forest Service often monitors from the air to watch for smoke. Bushell says because of dangerous wildfire conditions in Utah this year, firefighters are working to fully suppress any fires, even those that started naturally and are not threatening structures.
This year is a unique year with all of the fires that are going on, that there is still the suppression more so than the let fire do what fire should do on the landscape.
Again, that is Brenda Bushell with the U.S. Forest Service. Local team took command of the fire on Saturday morning. Well, the Kimball Arts Center is busy preparing for the annual arts festival that'll be held the first full weekend in August, the 7th through the 9th. Meanwhile, a number of other events are happening and still time to catch the current exhibit, Resounding. In the studio with details, I have Kimball Arts Center Executive Director Aldi Milliken. Good morning, Aldi.
Good morning.
So tell us about the current exhibition, Resounding. What's the concept behind this?
This is a really exciting exhibition that is an invitation to listen more deeply and to feel the weight and resonance of sound, to dwell in sound, to hear about how artists respond to sound or use sound in their work as sort of a catalyst for more thinking. And it's a really different show because it invites you to take a lot more time to listen, basically. And so we've kind of created all this ancillary programming around it that sort of adds to that sort of listening experience. But there are like record covers that have been created. There's installations that you can kind of fall into or kind of explore. And there's sort of representations of sound.
Yeah, so when we think of art, we think of it as something to look at. So how does this exhibition, I guess, encourage visitors to experience art differently?
I mean, we think of art as sort of this great tool of communication, and that and sound and our senses is one of those things that sort of we use, but we sometimes take for granted. I guess smell would be another one in a way, if you think about visual culture. And so one of the works actually by Kristen Marclay is a film where he's taken old movie clips and add them together, and they're all from the telephone game. And so it really adds like material that we've seen. You know, you got Humphrey Bogart, and you've got sort of more contemporary film, and they splice them together, and sort of forces us to listen. And we need a little bit more of that. listening piece in our world. So tonight actually is kind of a really exciting opportunity for people to listen more. It's a collaboration with Mary Toscano and Andrew Reese Shaw, who is a couple that have created our second listening session with a work called LFO. And it explores the sort of the intersection between language and quilting and synthesizers. Andrew works in alternative music, and his wife Mary creates these really interesting geometric quilts. And so it's the relationship between that visual aspiration or inspiration, and then Andrew's sort of sound. And they're going to be in the Kimball tonight at 6 p.m. To do a close viewing or a reflection or an activation, if you will, that requires some deep listening. So we want our folks to come down and check that out.
So how many artists kind of make up this exhibit?
There's probably about 10 artists in the entire show, so broad variety. There's one piece that is listening to the noises in the Kimball and sort of representing those in a sort of a language by one of the artists. And then we've got, you know, like I said, record covers and other things that are really quite extraordinary. But tonight, really, people should check out this work by Mary and Andrew.
Okay. Again, that's at 6 p.m. at the Kimball Arts Center.
Correct.
And then coming up at the end of the month, the 31st at 7 p.m., another event with two more artists. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that is The Splinter Beneath a Fractured Star by Moses Williams and Chaz Primack. And that is a collaboration, also sort of an immersive sound and video performance. It's blending the original composition of the moving image, and the piece really invites viewers to engage with space, time, and a perception of like a new way of representing art forms. I haven't seen that piece because we haven't had that work, but that should be really exciting. And that's again at 7 p.m. on the 31st. So mark your calendars. And then actually later on, and I keep moving with all these different activities, we have Sound Bath by Sophia Miletti. Yeah, exactly, right. She's a local artist. She's collaborating with Mountain Town Music. Obviously, we like to support our local artists, and so that should be really interesting. We've done some work with them before, with Sophia and Mountain Town Music, obviously, but that's on the 20th at 6 p.m., and I'm kind of interesting to see that work or their work within the context of this exhibition. Usually they come into the Kimball and it's a different show, but this is like a show made for them in a sense, as far as the context.
Okay, so I've been to a couple sound baths. I'm on a yoga mat. People need to bring one, or just is their chairs going to be set up?
There's more information on our website. Mm-hmm. I do think that we should probably pay attention to bringing something, because I think they'd like to have these sort of immersive singular experiences. I don't know about this one specifically, but there's definitely more information on our website.
Okay, and then a date coming up for parents to know about, the Young Artists Academy deadline. This is a pretty amazing program. It's been going on for, boy, as long as I can remember.
It really is. So tonight is the deadline for those young artists, right, today. So that's why it's appropriate that I'm here reminding our students, if you're a procrastinator like me and your best work comes in the last 5 hours, this is the time to share why you want to be part of the YAA, the Young Artists Academy. Those applications are due today. Please submit those. That program it is an extraordinary studio-based program. It is driven by the students who really mature and develop their own artistic language. It's phenomenal. I don't really know of a program, except like in a college-based studio program, anywhere in the country. Like, this is a really extraordinary program that is led by our education director, Heather Staminoff, and it continues to surprise and charm me with the quality of the work.
Yeah, so I believe it's year-long, or at least a school year-long program.
It is a school year-long. It'll start during the school year. Actually, if for those of us who don't have the skills of a lot of our young students, the YA students will have a booth at the Arts Festival, along with our clay students and other sort of creation students. So it's a really extraordinary opportunity. It's really about professionalizing your artistic voice. In fact, actually, one of our YA students, just to sort of jump around a little bit, one of our YA students, Elle Donovan, won the T-shirt contest for the Arts Festival. So she's continued to kind of develop her own artistic voice and create things. in a blind jury, she won the festival's t-shirt contest, which is really cool. It's great to see people. And you know you're doing a good job when people are connected and continue to come back to the Kimball again and again and again.
Yeah, so what's the design of, do you know?
I think people should check it out instead of me having me, but it's using a crane and kind of this really elaborate, beautiful representation of her work and how she sees us. It's really a great piece.
Okay. So what's the status with the new Kimball Arts Center there at Kimball Junction?
Well, so we are continuing, of course, with our purchase and sale agreement. But to step back a little bit, I just want to remind people that the Kimball Arts Center board and staff recreated a really detailed building brief that thoughtfully described the vision of the Kimball, the connection between exhibitions, education, and all of our programs, and what we can offer this community, what we need, you know, in a new space, in a new building. That took about 8 months of creating that vision. That vision then we shared with 12 architects. We actually took 35 architects. We brought it down to 12 architects, and then we shared this vision with those 12 architects. They responded in an RFP, and the board just last week reviewed the 12 and brought it down to 5. And what we're going to do now is the board is going to review the buildings of those 5. And decide who should come for the final sort of competitive round, which is the interview process, why they're the best, you know, answering why they're the best firm. And I mean, these are extraordinary world-class firms. Snohetta, Mass Design, Michael Maltzen, Thomas Pfeiffer, and Herzog & de Meuron. I mean, some of the firms that I would never have thought would be interested in proposing, you know, wanting to be in a competition, in a sense. It's not quite a competition, it's sort of a competition for a partnership with us on our new property and Kimball Junction. It's extraordinary. I'm so excited about this opportunity to learn from these firms. Herzog & de Meuron, I mean, they've done 200 cultural projects around the globe, some of the best museums, and they continue to sort of delight the museum goers and in their collaborations and sort of how they resolve architecture. You know, the other firms are extraordinary. We'll see what happens, but we're going to go look at buildings now to make sure that we have the best building. So that's happening. We're continuing the due diligence period, reviewing the property, you know, looking at things like water rights and, I don't know, all the things that a property, like purchasing a property has entails, and making sure that we have the property that we expect. All things have gone thumbs up. Everything's working well. Our partner with Six Ridge has been really wonderful, and we continue to sort of be thoughtfully engaged with that. And then obviously we're starting our feasibility phase. We're looking at fundraising opportunities, activating donors, asking people what they think we should achieve, and really finding collaborators that can help us get over the finish line.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned up front that the land purchase development agreement's still ongoing. I mean, because just recently it was the county council approved that addition of the additional density that's going to be required for you guys to even do this.
Yeah, and that was something that I always knew was part of the conversation, so that wasn't necessarily a surprise for me. And again, like, you got to separate out the development priorities, which is the development partner, and then the community part priorities, which is the council, you know, wanting to, you know, to make sure that there were a lot of community assets as part of this property, and the Kimball was one of those. And so the 30,000 square foot approval was separate. I knew it was separate, and you know, it's just a sort of a piece of the phase that you go through to create developments. They're very complicated. There is a structure and a timeline to these things, so. You know, that was an approval that, or a step that was really important. There'll be other steps that are important, development agreements, CCNRs, HOA kind of bylaws and things like that are not very exciting. Other people are lucky they don't have to go through those things, but it's important for us to do our due diligence, and the board committee that's in charge of this is being very thoughtful, very procedural, structural, and tactical in how we develop this building.
Okay. Best case scenario, what's the kind of the timeline then for construction and even opening?
As I've always said in here with you, Leslie, 5 years, we're in the 5-year timeline window for me anyway. The clock now is actually ticking, so it's under 5 years. I will say that we have 2 years of fundraising, 2 years of building, and then 1 year for Aldi to recover. it's about a 5-year. It's a very complex project. We want to get it right. We're not making mistakes. We're just being very thoughtful in how we kind of go forward. The board has been phenomenal in sort of keeping their energy up and also like maintaining a very thoughtful, structured process to this whole thing. It's really quite extraordinary to see the board and the staff working together to realize this goal for everybody. It's really exciting.
Okay. And finally, the Kimball Art Festival, of course, one of Park City's signature summer events. And we're going to have your director come in closer to the festival. But I guess, what can people expect? I mean, is it going to be much like we've seen in years past?
We ask folks after each festival what would they like to see more of, and so we learn and we evolve and still continue to create a very locally forward opportunity. Friday night is still locals night. One of the best nights of the year on Main Street. It's really exciting. Once again, to remind people, 193 artists are currently registered. We've got, it's a 16% acceptance rate, so there's high quality. Now's the time to buy your weekend passes. The proceeds from the festival support education and our exhibition program. We do need volunteers. So folks, volunteering is like the coolest club in the summer, like to be part of that. It's really fun. You meet your friends, you meet people, you help the Kimball, you get involved. This is a really supportive community. So please check out our website to be a part of the volunteering. You asked about new things. I know there's going to be more of a food truck activation site at the top of Main. We want to draw people up to the top of Main. So we are changing, that's more of a public space in a way. So there'll be water and drinks and food and something that complements the amazing food that we already have on Main Street. So, we know that with 10,000 people on the street, we want to make sure that there's a lot of opportunities for people to meet friends, to gather, to have beverages and whatnot. So there will be some changes. I think the other one, Miners Park, I think there will be sort of a moving. We've moved our education space a little bit. We've got students from the Kimball who are going to sell their wares as well, because they've done extraordinary work all year. So there's really kind of a cool, like there's a lot of, I would say, tweaks to make the festival better.
Okay, and then tell me about this new book that you've written the foreword to, or the introduction.
Yes, so the Kimball has co-published its first international book with a printing house and distributor, Skira. It's a collaboration with Carl Handel, who had a show about a year and a half ago. The show was entitled Less Bad. So we created this incredible hardcover book that has installation shots from the Kimball, has a foreword by me talking about the Kimball Art Center, and then some texts by some scholars, other artworks and other other activations, if you will, book activations by friends of Carl. And the book is really an extension of his work. It's like not a description of the show, it's more like an activation. It's more like a pushing what an artist's book should look like. And again, it is now all around the world. So if you're in Basel, Switzerland, or you're in Paris, or you're in Park City, or if you're in Salt Lake, or whatever, you will go to an art bookstore, you'll see that book. Actually, I was in LA last weekend with Carl doing a talk, and it was really kind of wonderful to kind of revisit his work. We're going to be doing a talk here sometime in October, and I'll let you know. But I wanted to share with you an advance copy, and I think it also represents the excellence that Kimball is trying to strive for. It's a great collaboration with an artist, well-installed work. Actually, we talked about the YA students. Carl did a little workshop with them, which is a lot of fun. So we're kind of marrying the professionalism of a professional artist and having students learn from him as well. So that is to be continued on that.
Yeah, and I guess why did this artist warrant a book and not others?
You know what? Making a book is incredibly hard. Carl really wanted to do a book as this extension of his work. And frankly, he did a lot of editing. We had Annie Tucker, my former board president, did a lot of the editing. And so it really became a collaboration of the moment. And the idea is to not exclude others, but to continue to strive for excellence, and this book represents that, especially as we're going into our capital campaign year. I've learned this is a lot of work. We won't be able to do it for every show, but it's important that we mark who we are by books like this.
Okay. Anything else, Aldi?
That is all. I think I've got it. Please check. I think Monster Draw coming up September 18th. Mark your calendars as a collaboration with the Arts Council. Can I just mention one thing about our collaboration with the school district? So the EVA Arts Integration Partnership with the Park City School District means that Kimball Arts Center content is going to support a new arts integration initiative with a school system. And that means full-time teachers collaborating with classroom teachers in all the elementary schools in Summit County. So it's for the four elementary schools. So what that means for parents who are listening, who have the kids in those elementary schools, you're going to expect art excellence that is supported by the Kimball and then facilitated by those new teachers. And it's really new. It's really different. It's really exciting. So arts integration in the classroom for all elementary schools, public elementary school systems with Park City.
So the Kimball is paying for these?
We are adding, institutional support, mm-hmm. but the school system is hiring these dedicated teachers. So if we think about what's happening with the AI and information and technology, art is the deepest form of communication. And students will be able to find their own artistic voices in all subjects in the Park City school system. It's a phenomenal new partnership.
Yeah, great to see art back in the schools.
It is.
Yeah. Oli, thanks.
Thank you.
On the phone with an update on the new facility programming and potential $150 million general obligation bond is the director of the Snyderville Basin Special Recreation District, Robert Parrish. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Leslie.
Yeah, so maybe just start by telling us what new programs or facilities that have been introduced this year that residents should know about.
Well, what we're trying to do is we know that we've got growth coming in the district, and looking at all of the development that's approved by County Council between the Tech Center development, the mall redevelopment at the Junction Commons and others, we're going to have about a 20% growth in the next 10 years. And so we know that the field house is at capacity. We've already heard from residents about the difficulties in getting on health and fitness equipment, cardio. Our programming there, such as our senior fit and our power hour, being limited in enrollment, and we continually have wait lists for those programs. There really is a need for additional health and wellness and fitness within the district. So we've been doing surveys with our strategic plan from 2024. We went out and asked residents, what they were looking for. You're aware of our effort we did back in May to kind of recap that and really are listening to what our residents want and need. And we know that there's a need for additional fitness. We know that there's a need for additional program space that we can have aerobics and things like our senior fit and the power hour. So we're looking at that. And what we asked folks back in May, we had kind of a smaller plan for some smaller facilities at two locations. And by adding these additional two locations, what we're hoping to do is set up three zones within the district that would allow residents to go to a daily fitness class or something that's closer to their home without having to come into the junction or get on the highway and drive. But one of the things we heard in May is that, you know, residents would prefer that if we were to do this, let's do it right and do everything that we, you know, we need to do. And, you know, so the program that we've come up with in looking at making the facilities bigger, which is one of the what we heard is that, hey, we're planning too small. Not that we need to go big, we just need to go right. And, you know, what we're looking at is that's going to potentially cost up to $150 million. It's not that we're going to spend that much, but I need to at least get an authorization to do that, to spend up to that. But if we need to spend less, you know, one of the things I think we are looking at internally is, okay, if we scale back and go to the smaller facilities that we were planning back in May, what's that cost difference? And really, the difference between, let's say, $125 million bond for two facilities versus $150 is really only about $25 a year in property tax valuation for the median home within the district, which is $1.3 million. So it's $25 is the difference. And if, you know, voters and residents really don't like the cost of that, which I completely understand, then, you know, we do need to look at just providing what's needed versus what's wanted. But I think the other thing that I think that I'd like for residents to understand is that while an individual may not see a need within a facility, let's say for the pool, an aquatic center, that an individual may not feel that that's not a need for them, their neighbor may. And that same neighbor that may want an aquatic facility may have a neighbor who, you know, really enjoys climbing and wants to do climbing. And that neighbor may have somebody who have a neighbor who has kids that really they need additional indoor field space. So we don't have an overwhelming majority of a user type here in Basin. We have such a diverse community with a lot of diverse recreational interests that I can't build a one size fits all because we're not a one size fits all community. We really do have a lot of diverse interests and needs. And so we're trying to meet the community's need, and that's, you know, really what we're looking at. And so we're trying to, you know, evaluate the most recent round of survey results and listening to what people are saying in social media and trying to decide, you know, what is the right program. We've heard from people that, you know, they would prefer us just to phase this and to build it later, knowing though that if we were to build it later, it will cost more later. And then there's always the risk that, you know, we would not be able to afford it, or, you know, later on. So, you know, we're trying to meet the community's needs. We know that there's definitely a need for health and wellness and fitness classes. We need to take pressure off of the field house. We need to accommodate for the new growth that we know is here. Plus, there's other growth that will be coming that just isn't officially on the books yet. There are developers that are in talks with county planning, and they're in the pre-planning stages for things over by Home Depot. So the district as a whole is growing. The east side of the district over by Silver Creek Village, which is where we have plans for one of the facilities, will be growing. But in just looking at what's going into the Kimball Junction area and at the Jeremy Ranch, particularly with the mall and the property that the county owns, there's more growth coming on the west side as well. So how do we take kind of a strategic approach to be able to provide that daily health and wellness to everybody across to all three zones? And unfortunately, we can try and do it as cheap as possible, as less costly as possible, but it may not meet everybody's needs.
Yeah. Well, and why not think about just doing it one project at a time? Maybe it would be something easier to get approved.
Well, there is the economy of scale, knowing that if we go and do this once, what we're planning on doing is, you know, building the facilities with similar materials, so we'd be able to do that and have the economy of scale, having a contractor buy the same materials for two facilities. And, you know, again, if we were to do this now, let's just say hypothetically at $125 million, one of them was a $75 million project and one was a $50 million building, that if we were to do that and I were to phase it and in 10 years come back, then that $50 million project very well could end up costing $75 million, and it would, in the long run, it would end up costing more. But, you know, that's not off the board. We're looking at it. So, you know, a lot of the public response we've gotten is that if we can only build one facility, then let's just build the one at Silver Creek Village. But, you know, that doesn't account for or take in consideration the residents that are currently on the west side of the district and those new residents that are coming. that will be contributing to the tax base. So that's where a lot of the growth, you know, that's where a lot of the growth is now. We see it coming, but we know that the east side will be coming in the next 10 years as well. So it's trying to have that balance of creating and building facilities to meet what our current need is right now based on the overloading of the field house and being ready such that in 10 years when all this growth does happen and it's realized, we don't have to come back and say, well, we've had more growth, we need to build another facility. It would be in 10 years is that we have the facility that can not only meet today's demand, but will be already sized and ready to accommodate the growth that will hit us in 10, you know, we'll be here on the ground in 10 years.
Yeah. Now, have you surveyed property owners about their tolerance for a certain bond amount? Because this was done back in 2024. And even then, I think we were talking about a $50 to $80 million bond, and that was too high.
I think the question that went into the survey for the 2024 strategic plan was a $70 million facility. And I think... I think it was right around 200 a year is what I think the question was. And looking at the bond amount, you know, it's not necessarily going to exponentially increase the more you go. So, like I said, right now, if we were to look at a $125 million bond, we would be right around 195 a year, or it equates to basically $21 per year per $100,000 of evaluation. At 150, that number per $100,000 of evaluation at home goes up to 2503. So it's not like we can say we'll cut out $25 million and all of a sudden you're going to save $100 a year, because the amount of the bond is spread across everybody that's in the district now. And then, you know, once these new facility, you know, these new homes come online, 20% growth, they'll be paying into that as well. So the overall share per household over the next 10 years will actually decrease because there will be more residents participating in the tax.
Okay. So one of the first questions taxpayers want to know is what will it cost me?
So right now, if we were to do the $150 million bond, on the median house, which is median house home value in the district, is $1.3 million. What that equates to is $203 per year.
Okay. And what is Basin Recreation's current debt?
So we currently have two outstanding bonds. Roughly, I want to say it's between $20 and $30 million. I don't have the numbers right. But we have the Series A and the Series B bonds. One of them is due to be paid off in a couple years, and another one matures in 2035. But one of the strategies we're working on with Zions Bank, Zions Public Finance, who would be our banker we'd work with on the bonds, is that we would do a wrap, which, you know, I don't have all the details and nuances. I'm not a finance banker, but basically we'd be refinancing our current debt so that we can reduce the amount. And the difference there between whether or not we wrap our current bond around our old bonds, or if we just do a level debt on just a new bond, is a difference of about $50 a year. So we're looking at creating savings by working with Zions to wrap our current debt and potentially refinance our existing bond debt as well.
Yeah. At one point, Park City School District couldn't get a bond approved and wanted to do the projects, went ahead and issued what are called lease revenue bonds. These come at a bit higher in interest rate. Is that something that the rec district would even consider?
No, I don't think so, because, you know, the rec district is one of those things that I really needs to be driven by public need and public want. The school district is something completely different. And I can understand the taxpayers' aversion, because right now this within the district, the school district represents about 45% of the tax bill. And while Basin is only about 10%, we're not the smallest, but we're not the biggest either. But one of the things we are looking at are public-private partnerships. So that if, you know, I said that if we build part of a facility, you know, let's say a climbing facility, for example, there's a lot of people that don't want the climbing facility, or, you know, don't want us to operate one. We would look at a public-private partnership where somebody else would build out the interior of the climbing facility and run it for us, and we would not have to pay for the operations and maintenance of that. We're doing something similar with, I've had negotiations with PC TOTS. One of the things we've heard from community members is they'd like to have drop-in daycare so they can come and work out, and that cuts across multiple generations, because we recognize that there are multi-generational families in the district where grandparents are taking care of the kids for mom and dad, and grandma and grandpa want to be able to come to the field house and work out, but they can't because, you know, they have the kids. So we're working with PC TOTS to have a public-private partnership where they could have a facility within one or both of our facilities. We're not likely to provide daycare for the community, which would account for the new growth that's coming, because a majority of the new growth that's coming, as the county has put within their zoning code, is for workforce housing. So workforce means there are going to be families coming. So we'll have a need for daycare, but having that ability for families, mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, whoever, to bring a child that may not be able to use a facility on their own to have a place for drop-in daycare, we're doing that.
Okay.
We're also looking at other public-private partnerships across the district. We're looking at potentially doing a learn to ski hill here at Trailside. We're in negotiation with a couple of groups within the community that would like to see that, to where, you know, they can build that on our property and provide that amenity for the community. And we have several other opportunities at the Silver Creek Village parcel as well. So we're looking at all options, and that includes, you know, how we go and pay for the operations. We are currently under contract with, and we've hired a third-party audit firm to look at our fee structure to make sure that the fees we're charging are market appropriate, but also making sure that our fees are adjusted so that residents pay a fair rate, but then non-residents pay a higher rate. And that's one of the things that I have continually heard from residents, is that they feel that the differential between what a resident pays and a non-resident pays is not right, and that residents are subsidizing non-residents who do not pay the property tax for our facilities are able to use. So we're taking a look at that as well.
Okay, I got to leave it there. Robert, thanks for your time this morning.
I appreciate it, Lindsay. Thank you.
Robert Parrish is the executive director of the Centerville Basin Recreation District.